She wasn't supposed to survive. Nadia Volkova was just a girl with a dream, thrown into a war that didn't want her to return. Flying plywood planes into enemy fire, she became a phantom of the night, feared by the Nazis, forgotten by her own country. But the war didn't end when the bombs stopped falling. It ended when she stopped hiding the truth. This is the raw, untold story of the night witches. Women turned into weapons, legends turned into ghosts. And now it's time you hear them. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you the Unstoppable Night Witches, unsung heroes of history. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. They gave us wings, not freedom. They say the sky is freedom, but the sky I flew in, it was a graveyard. There are things I never told anyone. Not my mother. Not the other girls. Not even the ones who died beside me, screaming through smoke and wind, voices swallowed by night. There are truths you bury so deep, they start to rot inside you. Fester. Decay. Until all that's left is this sour silence in your soul. That silence is where the story begins. My name is Nadezhda Volkova, but my sisters called me Nadia. Before the war, I was just a farm girl with more stubbornness than sense, born in the muddy outskirts of Smolensk with a hammer in one hand and a fire in my chest. My father was a mechanic, my mother a midwife, and both believed the party would save us from hunger. But the party didn't save us. It fed on us. I joined the Red Army at 18, fueled by a mix of revenge and foolish hope. My older brother Dmitri had been killed at the front 6 months earlier, blown apart by a mortar shell during a push through Kharkov. They sent his dog tags back in a wax paper envelope. No letter. No apology. Just silence. Like he'd never existed. The morning I signed the papers, it was snowing so hard the train station looked like a postcard from hell. A thin, wiry recruiter with nicotine-stained fingers asked if I could handle myself in the air. I said, "Give me a plane, and I'll show you." He smirked like I was a joke, but I wasn't laughing. They sent me to the Engels Military Aviation School for Women, where I met the girls who would become my family, my lifeline, and in some cases, my graveside whisper. We were all misfits, misunderstood, misused, and we all had the same look in our eyes, something broken, something burning. Our commander, Major Yevdokia Brashanskaya, had eyes like carved obsidian, cold, sharp, unyielding. She taught us how to fly, how to land on nothing, how to stitch bomb cloth when rations ran out, and how to pull the dead out of flaming fuselages. She never smiled. Not once. I think part of her died long before the rest of us even knew how to grieve. The plane they assigned us. The Polikarpov Patu. A wooden biplane. Flimsy. Open cockpit. No radio. No armor. Just canvas wings, a compass, and a cluster of makeshift bombs we had to drop by hand. The only thing protecting us from gunfire was speed, stealth, and the fact that our planes were so slow, German radar sometimes missed them entirely. You learn a lot about yourself when you're inside a coffin with wings. And believe me, that's what it felt like the first time I climbed into one. I still remember the night of my first flight. February 17, 1943. Temperature, minus 22 Celsius. Sky so dark it swallowed our shadows whole. We launched from a frozen strip near Krasnodar, the engines whining like dying animals. My co-pilot was Irina Kuznetsova, a violinist-turned-bomber. Her hands trembled before takeoff, but her aim was perfect. We flew without lights, without cover, without a goddamn parachute. If the plane caught fire, and it often did, you had two choices: crash or jump and pray for a quick death. That night, we were targeting a German ammunition depot near the river. Our orders were clear: drop the bombs, disappear. No hesitation. No deviation. But no one tells you what it's like to fly straight into gunfire with nothing but plywood and guts holding you together. The wind was deafening, slapping us across the face with frozen air. Every breath felt like knives in the lungs. My fingers were so cold, I couldn't feel the stick. When we cut the throttle to begin our silent glide, the world went quiet. Not peaceful. Eerie. And then, boom, the first explosion lit up the trees below like lightning trapped in hell. Irina dropped the payload like she was playing a concerto, smooth and precise. The earth erupted. Fire surged up through the forest. Our shadows flickered against the smoke like dancing demons. We pulled up. Hard. The two shook like it wanted to fall apart midair. Bullets whipped past us, tracer rounds stitching the night. I heard one crack past my ear. Another grazed the wing. But we didn't break formation. Not that night. Not yet. Back at base, they celebrated. Vodka. Cigarettes. Singing. Laughter that never reached the eyes. We had survived our first mission. But not all of us had. Anya Petrovna, barely 17, didn't make it back. Her plane was hit over the Black Forest. They say she tried to land it, but the wing gave out. Her co-pilot was thrown clear. Anya wasn't. They buried her with pieces of her aircraft still lodged in her ribs. I remember standing at her grave in the cold, staring at the wooden marker, thinking. She was just a child. And now she's history. We didn't mourn properly. There was no time. The war didn't pause for grief. But that night, as I lay on my cot listening to Irina's soft sobs across the tent, I felt something snap inside me. Not break, snap. Like a trap being sprung. The girl I'd been before, the one who believed in medals and justice and the glory of the motherland, she died over that forest. And in her place, I became something else. I became what they needed. What they feared. A witch. Not the fairy tale kind. Not the broom-riding, curse-casting kind. No. I became the kind of witch who flies at night with vengeance in her veins. The kind who drops death like snowfall. The kind who survives not because she's lucky, but because the fire inside her burns hotter than the bomb she carries. We manipulated everything. Our altitude, our timing, even our silence. The sound of our plane's engine would cut off seconds before impact. The Germans called it a whisper of death. They said the night witches couldn't be killed because they weren't human. Sometimes, I started to believe that, too. But the truth is, we were human. So fucking human. And that was the real horror. Because no one prepares you for the moment you realize your government values your body more as a martyr than as a soldier. That your commanders care more about headlines than your life. That the only thing separating you from cannon fodder is how quiet your engine can go before the drop. They gave us wings, yes. But not freedom. They gave us fire. But no shield. They gave us a name. But not a future. And yet, somehow we flew. Through fear. Through grief. Through betrayal. We flew with our hearts clenched and our eyes wide open. Not because we believed in the cause. Not even because we wanted to win. But because there was no other choice. Because up there, in the darkness, between one breath and the next, we own something the world could never take from us. Power. Real, raw, terrifying power. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't love it. Chapter 2. No sound but the wind. You don't hear death coming. Not when you fly like we did. Engines cut, gliding through blackness, heart thumping against your ribs like a warning bell only you can hear. There's no music. No movie crescendo. Just the wind. And the silence that wraps around you like a noose. They say silence is peaceful. Those people have never flown a bombing run in the dead of night. Our silence wasn't peace. It was war, condensed into a heartbeat. After our first successful missions, word spread fast. The Germans called us Nachtfechsen, night witches. Not because we looked like witches, but because they swore we flew on broomsticks. They said our engines went quiet right before a bomb dropped, and the next sound was hell opening up under their feet. They thought we cast spells, but there was no magic in what we did. Just strategy, and pain, and a kind of madness we wore like armor. We would fly 8, sometimes 10 sorties a night, one after another. No sleep, no rest. Refuel, rearm, lift off. Again, again, again. Our planes were so light and slow, the enemy radar often missed us completely. So we used it. We'd approach our target with engines roaring, then kill the throttle just before we reached them. Let the wind carry us like ghosts. We were taught how to ride the air, to use its flow like a pianist uses keys. Every movement mattered. One wrong angle and you nosedive. One wrong second, and you're lit up by flak and shredded midair. I got used to the rituals, the timing, the quiet, the nothingness before impact. It was in that void I started to change. There's a moment every soldier reaches when fear stops being fear and starts being routine. You don't flinch anymore. You don't pray. You just do. Like some part of your soul has signed a separate contract. One that says, I'll come back when this is over. Until then, don't wait up. I felt that shift on my fourth sortie that night. We were over an ammo supply post, deep in the woods north of Rostov. Fog had crept in low across the treetops. Thick like milk, and just as blinding. The stars were gone. The moon was a smear. Irina and I were flying blind, relying on instinct, adrenaline, and coordinates scribbled onto damp paper maps. 3 minutes out, Irina whispered over the wind, her voice clipped and focused. She never yelled. None of us did. Shouting felt like tempting fate. I checked my watch, then the horizon, then my gut. Something was wrong. The world felt too quiet. No searchlights, no tracer rounds, just endless, suffocating stillness. Pull wide, I muttered. They're waiting. She didn't question me. She just adjusted. That's how tight we'd gotten, reading each other's tone like a second language. We banked left, circled wider, and as we came around the opposite flank, boom, a spray of anti-air exploded where we'd been seconds before. They predicted our trajectory. They were learning, but so were we. I dropped the bomb manually, leaned out of the cockpit, pulled the lever, and prayed it wouldn't jam. The payload spun down in silence, and then the forest below erupted in a storm of fire and metal. Screams echoed through the trees, muffled but clear. Target hit. Climb, I ordered. We rose like moths fleeing flame. Engines coughing, wings groaning. Back at base, we didn't speak of it. We never did. We just landed, dragged ourselves out of the cockpit, and smoked in silence until the world stopped spinning. The silence became addictive. That wind before impact. That stillness before chaos. It was like holding your breath in a coffin and daring it to close. Sometimes, in that silence, I'd remember things. My brother Dimitri, his laugh echoing in the barn while we played chess with missing pieces. My mother's hands, thick with calluses from years of scrubbing floors. The way my father would light one cigarette with the dying end of the last. I'd remember who I was before. Then the bomb would drop, and the girl in those memories would vanish again. We learned tricks to stay sane. Some of us whispered poems into the wind. Others kept trinkets in our boots. Charms, photos, scraps of letters. Clara, the squad's radio tech, carried a broken harmonica she never played but always clutched when we flew. Sonia, our mechanic, recited battle stats like prayer beads. And Luba, sweet reckless Luba, carved a tally mark into her plane every time she flew a sortie and survived. She had 82 tallies. Then one night, she didn't come back. Her plane had taken a direct hit. No crash. No fire. Just gone. That was the thing. When you fly at night in a paper plane, death isn't cinematic. It's quiet. Instant. One moment there. The next, you're just not. The silence was what killed you. And the silence was what kept you alive. By month two, my body had changed. My fingers had blisters from gripping frozen controls. My skin was raw from the cold and fuel leaks. My eyes twitched involuntarily from lack of sleep. I could hear bombs explode in my dreams, sometimes waking up mid-scream, fists clenched, shirt soaked in sweat. But worse than all of that, I liked it. The adrenaline, the control, the power, the fact that in a world run by men and madness, I was a fucking force of nature in the night sky. No one saw me coming. No one could stop me. And that made me dangerous. It also made me a target. There were rumors that we were spies, that we used witchcraft, that we seduced officers for intel. The male pilots hated that we were outperforming them. Some even tried to sabotage our planes, loosening bolts, draining fuel tanks, misreporting our numbers. Once, Irina found sugar in our engine intake. A quiet death trap. Had she not checked, we wouldn't be here. She didn't report it. She just told me, and we both agreed. We're not just fighting the Nazis. We're fighting everyone. Even our own. But that made us closer. There's something about surviving together that fuses you. You stop being individuals. You become a single organism, a breathing, flying, whispering machine of vengeance and grief. We braided each other's hair before missions. Not for vanity, but because it was something human. Something ours. We told jokes, so dirty they'd make Stalin blush. We danced barefoot on the tarmac while the mechanics cursed us to hell. We wore the same clothes until they frayed into skin. But every time we took off, we whispered the same line. No sound but the wind. Because the wind was sacred, it meant we were still flying. Still alive. Still haunting the bastards who thought they could burn us from the sky. You don't hear death coming. You hear the wind. You hear your heartbeat. You hear the silence that comes right before everything ends. And when that silence wraps around you just right, you own it. You become it. And for a brief, burning moment, you are not a girl, or a soldier, or a puppet of the state. You are a witch, flying between worlds. And God help anyone who hears you coming. Chapter 3. The Price of Becoming Legends. They told us we were heroes. But what they meant was, we were useful. There's a difference. A hero dies for a cause. The useful ones, they die quietly, off the record, when their purpose no longer aligns with the image the party wants to sell. By the spring of 1943, the 588th was no longer just a rumor whispered in German trenches. We were legend. Ghosts. Demons. Witches. The things you told your men about to scare them straight. If you hear the wind and nothing else, you're already dead. Our names appeared in pamphlets. Our silhouettes were stamped across propaganda posters. Smiling, graceful girls with perfect cheekbones and medals gleaming against neat uniforms. They made us look like angels with bombs. But I wasn't an angel. And that medal they pinned to my chest? It didn't keep Irina's blood from staining my boots. That night started like any other. Sortie number 6. We'd been flying missions nonstop for 2 weeks. The fatigue had become physical, almost tangible, like dragging a corpse strapped to your back. I hadn't slept in 39 hours. My mouth was dry, my vision blurred, and every breath burned my throat from inhaling exhaust. We were tasked with bombing a fuel station near the outskirts of Kherson. Lightly guarded, they said. Minimal risk, they said. Just another run. Bullshit. We were ambushed 5 minutes after cutting the engine for glide descent. Spotlights hit us like searchlights from God. Flak exploded all around. I tried to maneuver, but something was wrong. The stick was stiff, unresponsive. Like it had frozen in place. That's when Irina screamed. It was brief. Hoarse. Not from fear. From pain. I looked over and saw blood spraying from her thigh, dark and thick and pulsing with every heartbeat. Shrapnel. Hot and jagged. A piece of sky-turned weapon. She didn't cry. She bit down on her scarf and kept her hands on the bomb release like a fucking soldier. That's how I remember her. Not bleeding. Not dying. Fighting. We managed to release the payload. It hit target. The fireball lit up the horizon like a second sun. We limped the two back to base. It coughed and whined the whole way, one wing trembling like it wanted to snap off mid-flight. I landed it crooked, metal shrieking against dirt. Medics rushed in, dragging Irina from the cockpit. I followed. Numb. Hollow, not yet processing. She died 10 minutes later. Not because the wound was fatal, but because the base hospital didn't have enough bandages. Let me repeat that. The Soviet Union had just used my face on a propaganda poster in fucking Moscow. And we didn't have enough gauze to save a 20-year-old violinist who flew 8 missions a night. That's when I broke. Not outwardly. Not in tears or screams. But something inside me split, clean down the middle. 2 days later, I was called into the operations tent. There was a man there I'd never seen before. Tall. Clean-shaven. Thin lips like paper cuts. His boots were polished enough to see a reflection in them. He introduced himself as Commissar Belaikov, the liaison from Central Command. He didn't shake my hand. He just said, "Comrade Volkova, we need your help controlling the narrative." Narrative. Not mission. Not lives. Story. He explained, in that slick, oily way politicians do, that Irina's death had created an opportunity. A young martyr. A talented pilot. A loyal daughter of the Soviet Union. Perfect for a radio tribute, a newspaper column. Maybe even a short film. They needed a quote. Something poetic. Something emotional. Something that made the party look good. I asked him what they were doing to stop more girls from dying the same way. What about supplies? What about better planes? He smiled and said, "That's not your concern. Your concern is morale." I wanted to scream. But I didn't. Because that's when I realized something even darker than the night sky we flew in. We weren't soldiers to them. We were symbols. And symbols are easier to kill than fix. The other girls saw it too. After Irina's death, morale tanked. Clara started coughing up blood, but refused to report it because she didn't want to be pulled from rotation. Lena developed a tremor in her left hand but stitched it into her glove so no one would notice. Sonia, our bravest mechanic, stopped sleeping entirely. She just sat by the runway with a wrench in her lap like she was waiting for something to break. And maybe, just maybe, she'd break too. But none of us cracked publicly. Because if you cracked, you got transferred. Or worse, reassigned to morale duty. Which meant photo ops, smiles, interviews, and never flying again. And for us, that was the cruelest punishment of all. We didn't fly for glory anymore. We flew because it was the only place we could be ourselves. The sky didn't ask questions. The sky didn't lie. It either took you or it didn't. Everything else, down here, was just politics. Then came the betrayal. And it didn't come from a German bullet or a faulty engine. It came from inside our own barracks. It started small. Someone tampered with Lena's compass, switched the orientation just enough to send her plane off course. She landed in the wrong quadrant and was nearly shot down by friendly fire. The brass blamed her for navigational error. Dr. Pei wrote her up for insubordination. A week later, Sonia found sugar in the reserve fuel tanks again. And then one night, during a critical mission near Dnipropetrovsk, Clara's plane didn't launch. Her engine had been gutted, deliberately. Sabotaged. She stood there on the runway, staring at her dead bird, eyes wide with something I hadn't seen since our first month, pure fear. Who was doing it? Who among us? And why? We cornered Belaikov, demanded answers. He shrugged. It's possible, he said, sipping tea like it was a picnic, that some male personnel view the 588th's popularity as an insult to traditional wartime hierarchy. In other words, men were pissed we were outperforming them, and no one was going to stop them from taking their revenge. They couldn't beat us in the sky, so they tried to ground us. From the inside, that night, I sat alone in the hangar. I remember the cold, the stench of oil, the soft drip of melted snow on metal. My fingers were numb, my stomach empty, my mind racing. Was this the price of becoming a legend? Not dying in battle, but living long enough to watch your story get twisted? To see your name used in speeches by men who never flew a second? To know that every bomb you dropped was one step closer to being erased from the truth? That night I made a decision. If they were going to use us, if we were going to be symbols, then I would choose what kind of symbol I became. Not a poster girl. Not a puppet. Not a victim. A weapon. Sharp. Unforgiving. Uncontainable. I would become the thing they couldn't spin. The story they couldn't script. The witch they couldn't burn. Chapter 4. Smoke over Berlin. They called it Operation Lantern. But we knew what it really was. A fucking suicide mission. Berlin. The heart of the beast. The stronghold of steel and flame. We were to fly under radar, cut through anti-air, and drop four barrels of crude homemade incendiaries onto a munitions plant deep in the West Sector. At night, with no support, no backup, no second wave, and they picked us, the 588th. Because we were good, because we were invisible, and because we were expendable. I remember the briefing like it happened 5 minutes ago. It was dusk, April 23, 1945, 1 week before Germany surrendered. The war was all but over. Everyone knew it. You could smell the desperation in the air, like a fire that burned through too much flesh and had nothing left but smoke. We sat shoulder to shoulder in the operations tent, boots caked in mud, uniforms reeking of diesel and blood. Our commanding officer, Colonel Gurin, paced in front of the map like he was reciting lines from a play. Calm, cold, detached. This mission will turn the tide, he said. We exchanged glances. The tide was already turning. What the hell was the point? He continued. The Führer's factories still produce ammo by the hour. Take out this plant, and we send a message to them and the world. Clara raised her hand. What's the risk projection? Silence. He didn't answer. Because the answer was total loss. Later that night, I found Gurin alone, smoking behind the generator shack. I asked him point blank why us. Why not send in heavy bombers? Why not wait for ground forces to finish the job? His reply, "Your legends, Volkova. Legends inspire fear." I wanted to hit him. Instead, I smiled, nodded, walked away. But inside me, something was unraveling. We prepped the planes in silence. It wasn't the usual kind of quiet, the tense anticipation before a flight. No, this was different. This was funeral silence, the kind that follows a diagnosis, the kind that knows the end is no longer an if, but a when. I stood next to my P2, running my fingers over the chipped paint, the bullet scars along the left wing. I whispered to her like I always did, "Not tonight, girl. We're coming back. We always do." I didn't believe it, but lies can be comforting when they're wrapped in ritual. Our crew for the mission was small. Just 6 planes. Me and my new co-pilot, Mir 11, a 21-year-old from Minsk with eyes like frost and a temper to match. She was good, green but fast, precise. Clara and Sonia flew together, always had. Lena paired with a newcomer, Yulia Krestova, tall, stoic, barely spoke a word but shot like a sniper. The 6th plane was manned by Zoya Petrenko and her cousin Dasha, our daredevils. If someone was going to roll a P2 through a flaming sky, it would be them. We didn't hug. We didn't cry. We strapped in and launched. And the sky swallowed us whole. Berlin by night was a city on fire. Not just from us, but from within. The Allies were closing in. Nazi command was collapsing. German civilians fled like ants from a kicked nest. From above, it looked like a dying machine coughing sparks into the sky. We flew low. Too low. At 600 meters, we were already under radar. At 500 meters, we were in their range. At 400 meters, we were prey. Searchlights painted streaks across the heavens, slicing clouds with brutal precision. Every few seconds, flak guns roared upward, black blossoms of death exploding like clockwork. I kept my hand steady on the stick, Mira watching the altimeter like a hawk. 3 minutes to target, she said. Copy, I muttered, though my throat was dry and my heartbeat thundered in my ears. We cut the engine. Silence. Only the wind. That whisper I used to fear. Now it felt like an old friend, brushing my cheek, holding my spine upright. Target in sight, Mira said. 2 o'clock low. Factory perimeter is glowing. I looked down, and that's when I saw it, children. Dozens of them, lining the outer fence, barefoot, holding buckets, probably slave labor. They weren't soldiers. They weren't enemies. They were bait. I hesitated. My fingers hovered above the release. I had trained for this, killed for less, but something inside me, some thread of human instinct, tightened hard. They knew we'd come, I said. What? Mira asked, panicking. It's a trap. The kids. They want us to hesitate. They know we won't bomb children. And that was the catch. If we pulled up now, we'd expose our position. Become easy targets. If we release the bombs, we'd be no different than the monsters we claim to fight. A second passed. Then another. Then Mira, quiet as a prayer, said, "They're already dead, Nadia. They just don't know it yet." And that was the fucking truth. They weren't keeping those kids alive out of mercy. They were using them as shields, until they weren't useful anymore. I clenched my jaw, pulled the lever. The bomb fell. We banked left, hard, dodging a new spray of gunfire. I didn't look back. 2 planes didn't return. Sonia and Clara vanished over the city. No wreckage found. Zoya and Dasha went down in flames. We saw them burning across the horizon, a red comet disappearing behind the buildings. I radioed, screamed their names. Static. Just static. We landed at base to silence. No applause. No celebration. Just a stack of folded uniforms, waiting for burial detail. Gurren met us on the tarmac. No smile. Just a nod. You did your duty. Duty. What a shallow word. He handed me a flask. For your nerves, he said. I didn't drink it. Later, I poured it on the ground where Sonia used to keep her tools. That night, I couldn't sleep. Not because of guilt, but because of what I'd felt. Not sorrow. Not rage. Relief. Relief that I survived. That I got to breathe again. That I could still hear the wind. And that scared the hell out of me. Because it meant the war wasn't just outside me anymore. It was inside me, crawling through my veins, nesting behind my ribs, reshaping who I was. Mira lit a cigarette and passed it to me. "I thought you were done smoking," I said. She shrugged. "I thought I was done killing." We laughed. Then we cried. Then we laughed again, because the cry made us feel weak, and weakness was dangerous. Berlin burned. The mission was a success. The brass wrote new articles. More posters. More interviews I refused to do. They called us fire from the sky. The final kiss of Stalin's fury. The witch queens of Berlin. But none of them asked who we lost. Or what it cost to get that headline. And we didn't tell them. Because sometimes, silence isn't just strategy. It's survival. Chapter 5. The Witch's Curse. They say when you stare into the abyss stares back. But that's not true. The abyss doesn't stare. It waits. It doesn't speak. It doesn't warn. It just stands there, arms open, quiet and patient, until you're broken enough to crawl into it willingly. That's how I became the witch. Not by mettle, not by nickname, but by descent. After Berlin, I stopped bleeding when I flew. I used to get nosebleeds from the pressure. Shaky hands. Nausea. My body, rebelling against the horror it was being asked to endure. But something shifted. I no longer felt the altitude. The cold. The fatigue. I became weightless. Detached. Empty in the most dangerous way, like I'd unscrewed the lid of my soul and let the wind take what it wanted. What remained? Focus. Precision. A kind of brutal clarity. They gave me a new co-pilot, Raisa Mikhailovna, fresh out of flight school. She had a face that still held softness. Round cheeks. Hopeful eyes. Poor thing thought the war was almost over. I didn't correct her. Hope has its uses. It gets you through takeoff. But I warned her of one thing. If you want to live, forget everything they taught you in training. She frowned. What do you mean? I leaned closer, looked her dead in the eye. Everything in that manual was written by men who've never flown with death chasing their tail. Out here, you fly dirty. You fly crooked. You cheat. You lie to the sky. Or it kills you. She didn't ask again. Our squad was down to 12 girls. 12 from the original 60. Some transferred. Some promoted. Most buried. And the replacements? They came in green. Wide-eyed. Dreaming of glory. Armed with stories of our so-called heroism. Eager to meet the infamous night witches. And when they met me, they always looked disappointed. I wasn't beautiful. I wasn't warm. I wasn't patient. I was functional. I did my job. I kept my girls alive. And I didn't give a fuck if anyone liked me. I think that's when the story started to change. Before, I was a name, Nadia Volkova. Night witch. Pilot. Now I was the witch. Not just a nickname. A legend. The one who flew through enemy fire without blinking. The one who never missed her target. The one who survived when others burned. It was bullshit, of course. I was lucky. I was angry. And I was done being afraid. But no one wanted truth. They wanted myth. And I was more than willing to give it to them. One night, we were tasked with a high-risk mission near the Dniester River. Intel suggested the Nazis were hiding a mobile command post in a stretch of abandoned factories. We'd flown that sector before. Empty shells, bombed-out skeletons. But this time, something felt different. I could feel it in the wind. Raisa kept checking the map, double-guessing our heading. I didn't blame her. The stars were hidden, and the moon was little more than a bruise behind the clouds. "Something's wrong," she said. I didn't answer, because I'd already decided. We were going in. We dropped altitude fast, hugging the treetops, engine cut. The wind whispered secrets as we glided into position. I gripped the bomb lever. One breath in. One breath out. My heart calm. My hand steady. Then I saw them, glints of silver beneath the brush. Not tanks. Bodies. Dozens. Arranged in rows. Dead Soviets. Officers. Some with their throats slit. Some stripped of rank. Their blood dark against the snow. Raisa gasped. What the fuck? And then we saw the ambush. A fake command post. Real enough to draw us in. But the anti-aircraft guns. Hidden in the shadows. Camouflaged. Waiting. It was a trap. Designed for me. They wanted the witch. The first shell missed us by a meter. The shockwave slammed into the fuselage, cracking the outer frame. Risa screamed. I didn't. I banked hard, right? Dragging the Patu into a dive, so steep the wings screamed in protest. Another shell. Closer this time. Too close. We hit tree line. I pulled up. Just in time. One engine coughed. Sputtered. Died. We were flying on hope now. And then it happened. A sniper's bullet punched through the cockpit. Risa jerked. Froze. I looked over. Blood leaked from her collarbone in a slow, syrupy line. Her lips trembled. Her eyes locked on mine. Am I dying? She whispered. I didn't lie to her. Yes. She nodded. Just once. Then smiled. And that smile, God help me, was beautiful. We landed in a clearing 2 clicks south of the target. Not a real landing. More of a crash that didn't kill us. I dragged Risa from the wreckage. She was still breathing. Barely. The wound was clean but deep. No exit. I applied pressure. Wrapped her in my jacket. Whispered to her until her eyes stopped fluttering. She died with her hand in mine. And I cursed the sky for letting me live. Back at base, I walked straight into Gurren's office. Slapped the mission dossier on his desk. You set us up. He didn't flinch. It was tactical risk. No. It was bait. And you used us. He sipped his coffee. That's what witches are for, isn't it? To haunt the dark? To draw the fire so others can move unseen. I stared at him for a long time. Then I leaned in and said, witches burn back. And I walked out. After that night, I changed my flight pattern. I didn't wait for orders. I chose my targets. Tracked German supply lines. Bombed key nodes off the books. Wrote my own damn strategy. Gurren couldn't stop me. By now, the higher-ups were too invested in the myth. Nadia Volkova, the unstoppable witch, hero of the skies, terror of the Reich. To punish me would be to kill morale. To restrain me would be to admit fear. So they let me burn. And in doing so, I became untouchable. But every night, when I flew, I carried ghosts with me. Irina, Clara, Sonia, Mira, Risa. Their voices whispered through the cockpit. Sometimes cursing me. Sometimes guiding me. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat much. I existed between takeoff and landing. Everything else was just filler. One night, I found Lena on the edge of the airstrip, clutching a broken picture frame. Her sister had died in a raid. I sat beside her. Neither of us spoke. Eventually, she asked, "Do you ever feel like we've become the thing we were supposed to fight?" I didn't answer, because I wasn't sure anymore. Power corrupts, but so does survival. You kill enough men, lie enough times, watch enough friends die, and you start to wonder if there's anything human left behind the metals. Or if all that's left is the curse, the legend, the witch. And if that's all you are, is that enough? Chapter 6. One Last Flight. By April's end, I knew something was coming. You can feel death before it knocks. You smell it in the fuel. Taste it in your morning tea. Hear it whisper through the engines during pre-flight checks. It lingers. Not loud. Not frantic. Just present. Like smoke before fire. And I'd learned by then, when the air changes, brace for impact. We were stationed at a temporary airstrip near the Carpathian foothills. High altitude. Low visibility. No radio towers. It was the kind of place they sent ghosts, the crews they didn't want seen anymore, the legends that had grown too large to manage. The party didn't say it aloud, but we all knew. We weren't being rewarded. We were being removed. Phase us out. Quietly. Let the war end without the burden of our inconvenient truths. It had been days since a real mission. Supplies trickled in slower than our blood leaks. We were told to stay sharp, but no one explained what for. Some girls thought we were being spared. I wasn't that naive. I was in the hangar when it arrived. A letter, sealed in red wax, delivered by a courier with dead eyes and clipped words. No envelope, no return insignia. Just 3 lines printed on beige cardstock. Operation Eclipse. Departure, 3 o'clock. Authorization, GB. GB. General Baranov. The same bastard who once told the press I flew with the grace of a ballerina and the precision of a scalpel. The same man who signed the orders that got Clara killed. I gather the girls, those who were left. Lena. Yulia. Vera. Zoya's younger sister Katia, now our mechanic, and me. Only five of us now. Five from the original 60. The rest had faded into medals, whispers, or shallow graves. The mood was tense. No questions, just knowing looks. We'd seen too many sudden orders. Too many secret missions, with no return. I handed the card to Lena. She read it, eyes narrowing. What's the objective? Doesn't say, I replied. Coordinates. Already logged in the flight record. Vera spat on the ground. They're sending us to die. Katia looked up from her wrench. Then let's make it loud. Midnight. I sat in the cockpit, staring at the instrument panel. My fingers hovered over the throttle. The PA-2 sat like a corpse waiting to be reanimated. Yulia climbed in beside me. What's our heading? Northwest. Low altitude. Unlisted airspace. No return flight. I didn't answer. She didn't need one. The takeoff was uneventful. The sky above us was clear, eerily clear. Not a cloud. Not a star. Just darkness, stretched thin across the world like fabric pulled too tight. The other girls flew in a staggered V. A ghost squadron. Five witches on their final run. The wind kissed the wings like it knew us. Like it remembered. For a brief moment, I felt weightless again. Then the engine coughed. Not a sputter. Not a stall. A cough, short, sharp, unnatural. I checked the fuel gauge. Full. All pressure? Steady. But something was off. I reached for the side panel. Ran my fingers along the seam. Cold metal. Then a smear. Sticky. Sweet. I sniffed. Sugar. Sabotage. I switched channels. Squadron break formation. Now. I repeat, break formation. No answer. Static. No. Not static. Jam. They were jamming us. Yulia. Manual override. Kill lights. We're landing. Her eyes widened. Here. Now. We banked hard, dropped altitude fast. Trees rushed up at us like rising fists. I found a clearing. Tight, uneven, surrounded by frost-drenched brush. We hit dirt. Hard. The plane bounced once, then skidded, snapping off the left wheel. The wing sheared. Sparks burst. The smell of scorched cloth and hot metal filled the air. But we stopped. Alive. Breathing. Just barely. I stumbled out, coughing. Yulia rolled behind me, clutching her ribs. The PA-2 was a wreck. But we were down. I scanned the tree line. Silence. Then movement. Men. Dozens. Emerging from the shadows in black uniforms. Not Germans. Not Russians. Private military. Mercenaries. And behind them, Commissar Belaikov. Smiling. Wearing my fucking medal. He walked toward me like he owned the earth. Comrade Volkova, he said. Voice smooth as poison. So good of you to join us. I didn't answer. My fists curled. You've become problematic, he continued. Inspiring independent thought. Deviating from command. Refusing interviews. Do you know how hard it is to manage a legend who won't play nice? Still, I said nothing. He gestured at the trees. You weren't supposed to survive Berlin. Or Dniester. But here you are. Defiant. Disobedient. He stepped closer. Operation Eclipse wasn't about bombing a target. It was about removing one. That's when it hit me. We weren't the strike force. We were the target. My vision narrowed. I felt Yulia rise beside me. Blood on her lips. Fury in her eyes. Belaikov smiled wider. Any last words, witch? I spat at his boots. Yeah, just one. And I reached into my coat, pulled the emergency flare trigger. Red light screamed into the sky. A signal. One that said, I see you. 2 minutes later, the other girls broke through the tree lean. Lena with a rifle. Vera with a blade. They'd heard me. Turn back. Risked everything. The firefight lasted 7 minutes. 7 minutes of chaos. Of screams. Of vengeance. When it was over, the snow was painted red. Belaikov was gone, escaped. But wounded. And we were still standing. Barely. But standing. We burned the wreckage. Hiked 2 miles to a nearby village. Hid. Repaired what we could. Stole a radio. Called it in. And then we disappeared. No return to base. No debrief. Just gone. We became ghosts for real. The official report said our unit was dissolved, reassigned for final war efforts. Our names were listed among the fallen, honored posthumously. Our photos displayed in a quiet corner of a forgotten museum. But that was a lie. We were alive. Scattered. Silent. But alive. And me. I kept flying. Low. Quiet. Unmarked. Helping where I could. Blowing up what needed to burn. There's a freedom in being dead to the world. You get to choose your afterlife. And I chose vengeance. I became a myth with teeth. The kind they whisper about in cold rooms. The kind generals pretend never existed. The kind who haunt silence. Because the war didn't end when the treaties were signed. Not for us. Not for the witches. Chapter 7. Silence after the fire. The war ended. But peace never came. At least not for me. Not for us. You don't just turn off the war like a radio. You don't step out of the sky, take off your uniform, and go back to brushing your hair in a mirror. You don't suddenly become a woman again. You stay in the air, inside forever. Floating between the person you were and the thing the world made you become. May 9th, 1945. Victory Day. The streets of Moscow overflowed with celebration. Flags, music, tears, vodka in every corner of the city. Men in clean uniforms kissed women they didn't know. Children danced between rusted tanks like nothing had ever burned. They said we won. That the nightmare was over. But I remember looking up at the sky that morning, crystal blue, cloudless, and thinking, why does it feel like I lost something I'll never get back? I didn't attend the ceremony. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't. Officially, Nadia Volkova was dead, killed in action during Operation Eclipse. And maybe she was. Maybe the girl who first climbed into a wooden biplane with trembling fingers and fire in her chest had truly vanished. All that remained was the whisper of her name, and the smoke trailing behind it. I spent the months after the war wandering. No home. No rank. No name. Just fields. Villages. Broken towns trying to reassemble themselves with the shaky hands of survivors. I saw boys too young to shave, trying to grow into the uniforms of dead fathers. I saw women sweeping ash from kitchens that had no walls. I saw mothers with hollow eyes pressing medals into coffins like they meant something. War doesn't end when the fighting stops. It lingers. In scars. In rituals. In silence. One night, I found myself in a nameless village near the Polish border. I slept in barns. Traded mending for bread. The man who owned the land didn't ask questions. He saw the shadows in my eyes and offered me quiet. I took it. For weeks, I did nothing but breathe. And every breath felt like a betrayal. Because I was still alive. And Irina wasn't. Risa wasn't. Clara. Sonia. Mira. Zoya. Dasha. Gone. I remembered each of their faces. Every laugh. Every scream. Every final glance. Some nights, I swore I could still hear them above me, voices in the wind, trailing through the rafters like ghosts who hadn't figured out they'd stopped flying. And then one morning, I heard a knock on the barn door. A woman stood there. Tall. Lean. Eyes like thawing ice. It was Lena. She hadn't shaved her head like I had. Her hair was tied in a neat braid, streaked with gray that hadn't been there last spring. But it was her. Still breathing. We didn't hug. We just stared. And then sat. Hours passed in silence. The kind you only share with someone who saw what you saw. Eventually, she pulled something from her coat. A rolled sheet of yellowed paper. I unwrapped it. It was a list. A long one. At the top, in her tiny, precise handwriting, it read, "The truth they buried." Beneath it, names. Missions. Coordinates. Dates. Every time the party lied. Every time they sent us to die and rewrote the story. At the bottom, one line underlined twice. "Tell them." I didn't sleep that night. I stared at the list until my eyes blurred. Until the ink bled. Until my fists clenched so tight I thought my fingers would snap. Tell them. But who was them? The world had moved on. The war was already becoming myth. The truth was already turning into propaganda. And yet, I knew she was right. We had become symbols. But now, someone needed to tell the story behind the symbol. The blood. The manipulation. The betrayal. the girls who fought harder than any man and died quieter than any hero. So I wrote, every night, by candlelight, I scratched our story onto scraps of paper, torn ledger pages, matchbox backs. The real story, not the official one, not the medals, not the posters, the truth, about what it meant to be sent to war with no parachute and a smile, about what it meant to become useful, about what it cost to be feared. I wrote until my hand cramped and my chest hurt. I wrote until I heard their voices again. Not crying, laughing. Years passed. The Soviet Union changed. Shifted. Cracked. In 1956, I snuck into Moscow with a bundle of pages tucked into my coat. I left them on the steps of a quiet archive building, and signed, unmarked, wrapped in a scarf that had once belonged to Irina. I walked away. Never looked back. They called it fiction when it was found. A creative interpretation of wartime stories. But I didn't care. The truth was out there, floating between facts and folklore. And maybe one day, someone would read it and know. Really know. What we were. What we did. And what they did to us. Now, I live by a lake. Somewhere with no name on the map. I watch the wind ripple the water. I drink tea. I braid my hair some mornings. Not because it matters, but because we always did before missions. Old habits don't die. They just go quiet. Like engines. Sometimes I hear a plane in the distance. And for a second, I'm back in the cockpit. The wind on my cheeks. The silence before the drop. The ghosts riding shotgun. But when I open my eyes, it's just the sky. Empty. Still. As if it, too, is remembering us. They never built us a monument. No statues, no national day. But if you ever stand in a field and feel the wind shift without warning, if you hear a low whistle and nothing else, that's us, still flying, still watching, still haunting the silence after the fire,